Let's begin today's show with a contextual fact. According to what we know from historical records, the very first Olympic Games in antiquity can be traced back to 776 BCE.
Ben.
Noel.
You've blown my mind.
It's weird when we think about just how ancient that practice was. Now, the games did not occur every year continually from that point.
Yeah, there was a lull, about a 1,500-year lull, as it turns out. And then it was kind of resuscitated by a guy by the name of Pierre Baron de Coubertin.
Yes.
And Casey Pegram joins us.
Hello.
Is that correct?
Yeah, Pierre de Coubertin.
And that's been Casey on the Case from our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Whoa.
You cool with those double sound cues?
You flipped the script there, my man. I love it. But no, Pierre, who was originally known by Pierre de Fredé. Casey?
Pierre de Fredé. Fredé.
That's why he's here.
He's here for a lot of reasons.
He's here for amazing reasons. Okay. So tell us about this guy.
Now that we've jacked up the flow entirely with valuable pronunciation information from Mr. Casey Pegram. Yeah, this guy was an educator from France who totally revived the Olympic Games in 1896.
In Greece.
Indeed, Ben, as it would be appropriate to do, I guess, to carry on that torch.
There we go.
Yeah, it was in Athens in 1896. And by most accounts I've read, that one went okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had one in Paris, which was apparently a ship show. And then they had one that is the subject of today's episode in Old St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes.
Missouri.
Missouri,
you got it.
write in or chime in on Ridiculous Historians, local Missouri residents, to let us know how you prefer to pronounce it.
Shred us. We welcome it.
I'm having so much fun with that. So it's true, Noel. America's first Olympic Games, the first Olympic Games in the U.S., were held in 1904 in St. Louis or St. Louis, and they were tied to that year's World Fair, which happened in the same city. And there was even, okay, so before we get too deep into this, folks, things were already starting off on a bizarre, awkward, and terrible foot when the 1904 Olympics moved to Missouri, because they were originally supposed to be in the U.S., but supposed to be in a different city.
Yeah, in the city of Chicago, which I'm very much looking forward to traveling to next weekend to see the band My Bloody Valentine. That's all I'm going to say
fantastic.
About that.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to it. Chicago is a beautiful city, but unfortunately, St. Louis made some problems for Chicago, because St. Louis was already set to host this World's Fair, which had a really interesting name that was not the World's Fair. It was called the Louisiana Purchase Centennial Exhibition. And they were none too happy, the organizers of that little shindig, none too happy that the Olympics were going to give them a run for their money during the same period in the summer in Chicago. So they threatened, according to this article, by Nate DeMeo of Memory Palace fame on Slate, to out-Olympics the Olympics. In other words, making it such a big dog and pony show that the Olympics, which was not as widely known at the time, it being only the third year, would probably suffer significantly. So Coubertin was like, okay, I guess we better play ball with St. Louis.
Yeah, they said specifically that they were going to make the official Olympic events in Chicago look terrible, look pitiful in comparison. And at this time, the Baron was still trying ardently, because remember, this isn't too far past 1896, still trying ardently to resurrect the modern Olympics and give it the credibility it deserved. He wanted to avoid any controversy. And he said he would, you know, for the greater good of the Olympics, back down and award the location to St. Louis. But the problem was, first off, most people in Europe at that time probably had not heard of St. Louis at all.
Yeah, you know? It's described as a second-tier city, which I think is insulting. St. Louis is beautiful, but New York it is not.
I mean, I went to St. Louis recently on some unrelated adventures, and I got to say, it's an amazing city, amazing music, amazing barbecue, if you like barbecue. But at this time—
They got that arch.
Right? But at this time, the location there in what they did describe as a second-tier city was an incredible barrier to athletes, especially European athletes. We have to remember this was before an interstate system, so travel to the American Midwest was a daunting task. And almost all of the top European athletes didn't make it. And ultimately, fewer than half of the Olympic events that year had even a single entrant who was not from America.
And I want to say I read somewhere, and I'm sorry for being vague about this, folks, but that America actually scooped up some European athletes and made them part of the American team, or folks that had recently immigrated to America but had not received citizenship yet. And they were the ones who won many of the medals. And there are countries that are to this day disputing those wins because they basically kind of sniped some of their people and they weren't officially citizens of the United States. So very Wild West kind of Olympics here, and sure, for more reasons than one.
Yeah, sort of shooting from the hip, right? Going, winging it a little bit more than is appropriate. Did we mention the mastermind behind this, Noel, James Edward Sullivan?
No, we have not, but he's a huge part of the story.
Okay, so James Edward Sullivan, American sports official. He was born in 1862. He lived until September in 1914. He was the chief organizer of these 1904 Summer Olympics. And a lot of the terrible, terrible mistakes that occurred fall upon his shoulders in this situation. He's the one who was putting out the threats. He's the one who was pushing the Baron to move this. And he is one of the reasons that so many disastrous things occurred with the actual events.
He was the organizer of the World's Fair, correct?
Great question, Noel. And it's important that we clarify that point. So James Edward Sullivan is the primary organizer of the 1904 Summer Olympics, but the organizer of the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, which we've also seen both ways as either Louisiana Purchase Exhibition or Louisiana Purchase Exposition. The organizer of that stuff, whatever you want to call it, was a guy named David R. Francis. And the problem with this was that the St. Louis organizers treated the Olympic Games sort of as a sideshow to the World's Fair.
Because the World's Fair is a big deal and very well established at this point.
And there were other more popular, let's call them cultural exhibits. We're going to be remiss if we don't mention some of the stuff that happened in those exhibits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were overshadowing the actual Olympic Games and events. And I believe in the 1904 Games, the total number of athletes was only 651. It was 645 men and 6 women.
And yet, for some reason, it went on for like 175 days, which I thought was bizarre. Let's backtrack just a little bit back to the World's Fair. So you were talking about, let's talk about some of the things that made the World's Fair kind of cool. You had, you know, the kind of things you'd think about being at a fair. On this particular one, they had Abe Lincoln's log cabin from when he was a boy. Okay, I guess that you wouldn't see that at most fairs. But they also had waffle cones. And, you know, newfangled contraptions and inventions. And I think this is where, like, peanut butter was debuted.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned it. Okay, yes, quick interjection. There's a fantastic article from Serious Eats by a guy named Robert Moss, the 1904 World's Fair, A Turning Point for American Food. There were a lot of amazing food things that happened here. Allegedly, the first hot dog ever was made in the sold in the 1904 World's Fair when a vendor named Anton Feuchtwanger was giving out sausages to people, but they were too hot for people to hold. And so he had his brother-in-law bake buns to hold the meat, creating the world's first hot dog. It's important to us through this episode, fellow ridiculous historians, to try to find some pluses.
Yeah.
But so please go on about the World's Fair. I have this list of amazing food stuff too.
We can keep going with that if you like. I'm just trying to, you know, put a silver lining on this story. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
Peanut butter is not enough of a silver lining for where we're going. We might as well just go ahead and get there. One last little thing about Coubertin, who, by the way, was the guy who reestablished established the International Olympic Committee. Mm-hmm. That was his deal. So again,
the Baron.
So we're a third year of this event after 1,500 year lull. The stakes are high. He's kind of strong armed into going to St. Louis and was so peeved at the whole thing that he actually didn't even show up. He is quoted in saying that he had sort of a predisposition to assuming that the quality of the Olympiad would match the quality of the city.
Yeah.
So kind of turning his nose up at St. Louis here.
Let's give him another quote, too, that'll get us to, I think, the meat of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Also, these are the early days of the hamburger. I'm just going to, whenever we get too much disturbing stuff, how about we throw in a fun food fact?
Sure, that sounds good.
Okay, so in addition to his objections to the overall mediocrity or potential for posed by the 1904 Olympics, the Baron also took disapproving note of a spectacle, a very problematic spectacle, called Anthropology Days. Before we tell you what those are, before we explore that, let's just go with this quote. He says, referencing these, "As for that outrageous charade, it will, of course, lose its appeal when black men, red men, and yellow men learn to run, jump, and throw and leave the white men behind them." Think of all the problems with that.
Yes, but at the same time, oddly forward-thinking compared to the story we're about to tell you. So why don't we just launch right in? It's sort of twofold. It's interesting because even Ben and I off air were a little confused about who was actually hosting these Anthropology Days. As it turns out, it was kind of a partnership between the Olympics and the World's Fair. So I'm a little confused about how this guy, James Sullivan, who kind of was the chief organizer of the Summer Olympics, wasn't like given the thumbs up from the Baron himself. But that we haven't quite run across that particular minutia yet. But here's the story. James Sullivan, he believed 100% in the utter superiority of white men and wanted very much to put on a display or a charade, as the Baron referred to it, to demonstrate this fact. So there was this thing that was a very strange phenomenon at the beginning of the 20th century called human zoos, which were sort of like traveling carnivals, or it would be like the equivalent of a freak show or a sideshow, where indigenous people from places like the Philippines or Africa would be displayed in kind of mocked up versions of their traditional homes.
Yeah.
But they would be, you know, there's images in this really great article from Timeline called "Scientists Staged a Racist Olympics in 1904 to Prove White Superiority" that shows people just gathered around these picket fences and looking at children, men, women, all kind of doing what they would be doing in their villages, for example, right?
Yeah.
So Sullivan wanted to take this a step further. And the World's Fair itself had a mocked-up Filipino village, because at the time, the Philippines was a newly established territory of the United States. So it was they wanted to show their dominance.
Well, yeah, he wanted to legitimize it, too, legitimize this belief, which was already, at that time, not considered controversial. That's when he contacted a Dr. W.J. McGee, who was president of the American Anthropological Association and head of the Department of Anthropology at the St. Louis World's Fair. McGee thought because indigenous people lived in harmony with nature, they were endowed with special strength and abilities that, quote, white people simply didn't have.
Yikes.
And so he was compelled, perhaps for some different motivations, by Sullivan's concept, and they began organizing these Anthropology Days, which they sometimes referred to, apparently informally, as Special Olympics.
Yeah. Yeah, not the way we think of that term today.
Right.
And, you know, McGee did have a scientific background and thought that he was conducting research, but he had this preconceived notion that we mentioned earlier that indigenous people had certain advantages, typically had to do with strength or endurance or things like that. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to build this hierarchical diagram of genealogy of the human species, of which he thought these indigenous people were at the bottom because his main concern was in intellect.
And he clearly subscribed to the concept of eugenics and selective breeding, which was alarmingly popular in or accepted in the U.S. at that time. So they stacked the odds against these people. They took several people from these exhibitions, like what you mentioned earlier, Noel, the exhibition featuring people from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you'll compete in a special version of Olympic events on August 12th and 13th of that year of 1904.
Right.
And all their competitions that they put these people in were European-style competitions, shot put, high jump, long jump, running the mile, other stuff. But they didn't teach the participants. They didn't tell them a damn thing about what they were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and I mean, even I— a lifelong citizen of these United States, I don't know the rules of the high jump or the right form or how to do it properly, or, you know, I really don't. And then that sounds, you know, like it would be so apparent or intuitive, and it's just not.
There are very specific regulations, yeah, too, for, yeah, any professional sporting event. So from what I understand, correct me if this is off, from what I understand, they didn't tell them anything. There's obviously a language barrier. Mm-hmm. They didn't tell them anything. At most, for instance, in the 100-yard dash or whatever, the participants just sort of got the idea that they were supposed to run. But in many cases, they just saw a gun fired. Mm-hmm. And were like, what next?
Yeah. Or they were just more fascinated with the weapon itself and the loud noise that it made than what it signified, which just seems just so ridiculous and short-sighted to me that they would just assume that that these folks would have the cultural knowledge of how these games work. That's just bonkers to me.
They also had tennis, which is weird, because tennis is something, like, look, even if you're skeptical with our explanation here and you think, well, sure, you can just relatively easily explain to someone the basics of something like a high jump or a 100-yard dash, tennis, I think we can all agree, has very specific equipment, rules, and strategies. This Anthropology Days exhibition, or this event, whatever you want to call it, was a huge failure. There was very little notice, so there were not many people even in the crowd to watch. And Sullivan thought, at least, that the games were somewhat successful for his ulterior motive, because he said, aha, this proves that these, and this is a terrible word, but to him, this proves that these quote-unquote savages can't play tennis.
Oh, cool.
Good job,
that's
Sullivan.
That's super, super helpful data there. All of these presuppositions that these guys made were based on the kind of inherent just thoughtless racism that we kind of take for granted today that most learned people would hopefully not be party to. For example, they assumed that anyone from a nation in Africa, for example, where spears were thrown as a means of hunting and protection, what have you, would automatically be good at throwing a javelin. You know?
Yeah.
You know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of, there's an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm where one of Larry's friends has adopted a Chinese baby, and Larry immediately asked them, so is he like automatically good at using chopsticks?
Yeah, I mean, those are horrific things to think. And of course, Larry David, we can safely say, is lampooning that and mocking it and does not himself believe it.
But there is another angle here because of the thing you mentioned earlier where it's like, because these folks were closer to nature and did these things as part of their everyday life, it's not just a nurture thing. There's also a nature thing here where they assumed that because they had done these things in their day-to-day, they'd be able to immediately one-to-one translate them to some kind of silly game. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. For example, the folks who tried the javelin that were from these nations that used spears, mm-hmm, were terrible at it.
Yeah. And I think also there's an important point we have to make about these people. So according to that Timeline article that we cited earlier by Shoshi Parks, these people were already put in horrific conditions. So more than 20 million people attended the 1904 World's Fair, right? They saw electricity. They heard the first telephone. They also went to see 3,000 people who were placed in these exhibitions, people from the African continent, the Asian continent, and parts of the Americas. But the way these people were forced to live was incredibly dangerous. Regardless of the weather, they would be forced to wear traditional clothing. I'm doing air quotes here, even if it didn't suit the climate. And then, like, people who were forced to live in that Filipino village would be made to perform traditional rituals that were only supposed to happen seasonally over and over again to shock or entertain an audience. There were appalling sanitary conditions, and a lot of these people felt that they had nowhere else to go. They were stuck in this alien environment, and imagine being pulled out of that. So your life is already not at its best. And then this Sullivan guy comes with some other people, grabs you, gibbers at you in English, hands you a javelin, and clearly thinks that he is going to prove that not only he, but anyone who looks like him is inherently better than you.
I'm also confused, though, because he talks about how he had these ideas that they would be superior physically. So what was he getting at? I'm confused.
I think it was McGee who thought he could prove specific physical advantages.
Uh-huh.
And it was Sullivan who thought he could prove that what he saw as white people was inherently superior.
So I guess the reason it's so confusing to me is because the logic behind literally all of this is utterly convoluted and bizarre.
Yeah, and a lot of that convolution and bizarre nature comes from the fact that it's based on things that are completely wrong.
It's true. And here's an interesting fact, too. Nate DeMayo's article in Slate, he points out that these folks, though living in what he refers to as quasi-captivity, mm-hmm. Were paid, probably not much, and obviously they were living in horrible circumstances, but some of them even had, like, managers or agents, mm-hmm. you know? It was almost like being a, I don't know, Santa Claus impersonator or something. But the problem is a lot of these folks that were in these human zoos were never fully able to assimilate into American culture.
Right.
And they were kind of held back by, here, we're giving you an opportunity to
not really
live, but just barely, right?
Yeah. And for McGee, the body of data that he wanted to collect from this to prove his wackadoo notion of racial hierarchies and certain inherent advantages or disadvantages, he didn't get it. We don't know if that body of data ever existed.
They did give it another go, though.
Mm-hmm.
There was a second attempt at this, unconnected to the Olympic Games, mm-hmm. Where they did try to teach them the sports. You'd think that would have been front of mind the first time, but they just seem to have missed that entirely.
Yeah.
How'd that one go? Did that any better results?
No. Yeah, it turns out, if you base something on a terrible idea and nonsense the first time you try it, it'll still be a terrible idea and nonsense the second time. While we're at this point, I just want to mention another fun food fact.
Oh, please. I'm so ready.
Light. Okay. So apparently at the 1904 World's Fair, when it was hot, there were very few people interested in this hot tea offered by a guy named Richard Blecton, who was the tea commissioner in the India Pavilion. And this guy got so desperate that he decided to pour his tea over ice. And supposedly, according to legend, he invented iced tea.
Well, then.
The drink.
Yeah. Not the rapper.
not the lyricist.
Only though. Iced tea invented iced tea. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where do we go from here, Ben?
I guess, we should also say that, you know, I think we did mention, and you know, I hope we established that the concept of human zoos was not unique at all, right? You mentioned earlier, it wasn't unique at all to the World's Fair. It existed in other parts of the world, in Europe as well. It is better for history, of course, that this proved to be a failure. There were some other firsts that occurred during the Olympics, so in some ways, it wasn't a complete disaster. It was the first time boxing, freestyle wrestling, the decathlon, and dumbbells made their debut in the modern Olympics, right? And luckily, James Sullivan would go down in history as the fool he was, which I consider a positive aspect.
Absolutely. How so?
Because he was clearly and categorically proven wrong, espousing a belief that was both offensive and incredibly common at the time. So I consider that a win for our species overall.
Yeah. All right. Well, in the spirit of staying ridiculous, because while this racial shenanigans is absolutely ridiculous, it's also pretty depressing and quite dark when you think about it. The idea of human zoos, mm-hmm. it reminds me of that the episode we did about the real human skull that was found in the diorama at a museum, mm-hmm. and the idea of grave robbing these indigenous people and taking them back to Europe and taxidermizing them.
Sure, imperialist culture thieves.
Oh, we haven't even mentioned the fact that a lot of this attitude was entirely based on the idea of imperialism of the United States. It was a stat, you know, we had gotten this territory of the Philippines. We had this Filipino reservation, right? And it was this idea of showing our cultural dominance.
I would say it's ultimately descended from the European ideals that the Americans just, they didn't invent it.
No, for sure. But this is a really clear example of, you know, trying to put that on full display. So let's end with one funny story.
I advance to end with food facts.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. So next to last thing.
So you folks don't leave completely depressed.
Yeah, this one's kind of depressing too, but in a
but
much
it's
more
funny.
Lighthearted, funny way. So the marathon at the Olympics themselves was just utterly disastrous. Mm-hmm. The winner, a guy named Thomas Hicks, he finished in an absurdly long 3 hours and 28 minutes. And that is because the conditions were just abhorrent. It was 90 degrees. It was on a road that was covered with dust. And I think, according to history.com, 18 of the 32 folks that were racing had to pull out because of sheer exhaustion.
Yeah.
Somebody got a stomach hemorrhage and nearly died.
That's William Garcia of California collapsed and had to be hospitalized because dust had coated his esophagus and ripped his stomach lining.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm glad we're ending with the food facts. So, yeah, Thomas Hicks, he won with that ridiculously slow time, but only because his assistants kept feeding him doses of eggs and strychnine, egg whites and strychnine, and brandy to keep him on his feet.
Yeah, at the 10-mile mark, they had to start taking care of him. He had begged them for a drink, and they refused. They sponged his mouth out instead. Strychnine in small doses was common as a stimulant at the time. And I know how weird it sounds, but there were no rules about performance-enhancing drugs. But he was the ultimate winner. But did you hear about Fred Lors?
No.
He's my favorite guy.
I don't know about this one.
Of Fred Lors, okay. So this guy, Fred Lors, L-O-R-Z, he leads the starters from the time they fire the gun. But by the first mile, Thomas Hicks hedges ahead. And Lors, at the 9-mile mark, started getting these crazy stomach cramps. And so he decided to hitch a ride in an accompanying car, and he waved at his fellow competitors as he ran. And then he rode in the car for 11 miles. And then one of Hicks's handlers, one of the strychnine egg white guys, saw Lors and ordered him off the course. But Lors said, eh, and kept running and finished with a time of just under 3 hours. And the crowd went nuts and they were like, yay, an American won. And then someone, I think President Theodore Roosevelt's daughter, placed a wreath on Lors' head and was about to put the actual medal around his neck when somebody finally busted him. The cheers turned to boos, and we don't know if Lors was as sincere when he said this, but he smiled and said, I never intended to accept the honor. I finished only for the sake of a joke. And it's like, really? That's how you let it get that close to a gold medal?
I don't know, man.
I don't really buy it.
It's a good story, though.
But Hicks does become the winner, right?
Yep.
Because he didn't hop in a car for 11 miles.
That's right. He hopped on his feet while... I'm picturing him vomiting constantly, clutching his guts, screaming for water, having his little toadies pouring some disgusting mixture down his throat. You know, that's how you typically picture a marathon runner, right?
No. Right. That's the glory days picture. So as we said, there were a lot of food facts we were pointing to when we entered more difficult parts of this story. I want to give a little bit of a gray lining here. Because some of those stories, while inspiring, are pretty easy to debunk. If you were writing an email now about iced tea, again, the drink, the truth is that it had been around for decades beforehand.
Yeah, I guess if you're the one that got the booth at the World's Fair, you might get the credit in history. But thankfully, we've got sites like Serious Eats that do a great job of debunking that stuff. What did they say about the actual origins of iced tea, Ben?
Oh, yeah, the actual origins of iced tea, which are interesting on their own, occur at least by 1868, probably way before. 1868 is like 3 decades before the World Fair. A widely circulated newspaper piece notes that iced tea with lemon juice is said to be a popular and healthy drink and has instructions for making it. And it's also in numerous cookbooks. So I think a lot of the marketing of World's Fair stuff is just that, marketing. Mm-hmm. And we have to be careful because marketing, you know, is a glitzy version of the truth.
Do you think it wasn't really Abe Lincoln's boyhood cabin that was there, just some sort of replica?
I don't know. It also reminds me, you know, all those old medieval counterfeiters, like a Canterbury Tale, who would run around with fake reliquaries and
stuff. Oh, like the Pardoner's Tale?
Yeah, like the Pardoner. But we do believe it is important for us to acknowledge these things and realize that in 1904, at the World's Fair, people believed they were on the cusp of scientific innovation, you know, that they were on the bleeding edge of technology. And in some ways they were, but their own preconceptions, their own prejudices, their own pre-existing notions limited the scope of their vision. And hopefully that's something that we can learn from in the modern day. I feel like I'm stretching to make it a little bit of a parable.
Now you're doing a good job, Ben.
You like it?
I do. It's a good way to frame it. Yeah, but there you have it. To quote Robert Lamb of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, our sister podcast. So yeah, I think we leave it there, right, Ben?
I agree, Noel. We hope that you have enjoyed this episode. We would like to thank you for listening. We've been doing more and more sports-related stuff recently. Have you noticed that?
Which is weird, because I don't think either one of us are into sports. And it's possible that that shows in the episode. But we come to it with honest hearts.
Honest hearts. Honest hearts. And as fans of history, if nothing else. So thank you for checking out the show and taking this strange journey with us. Thank you to our super producer, Casey Pegram. And thank you to Eves Jeffcoat, who was our research assistant for this episode.
If you want to reach us online, you can check us out on social media at Ridiculous History at Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Or you can join our Facebook community, The Ridiculous Historians. There's always all kinds of fun conversation and memery going on there. If you don't want to do any of that, you can write us an email at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. And I think we did not yet thank our pal Alex Williams, who composed this tune.
Thanks, Alex.